Welcome to episode 6 of Stories of Recovery podcast. This episode is called Addiction and Recovery. The podcast is a collaboration between Mental Health Ireland and the HSE Cavan Monaghan Mental Health Services as part of the Connecting for Life strategy to reduce suicide in our communities. My name is Miffy Hoad and I'm a Development Officer with Mental Health Ireland. I host the conversations here on the Stories of Recovery podcast. It's widely recognised that the sharing of personal narrative and lived experience of surviving and recovering from adverse events in life offers hope and inspiration to those who may be going through something similar. It's been shown to promote help-seeking behaviour and encourage people to reach out for support when needed. It's our intention that the conversations we have here in this series of podcasts will bring hope and inspiration to you, the listener, and encourage you to reach out should you need support. We also hope that the conversations here add meaning to the experience of those involved in helping to spread the word that recovery is real and possible, even from the most difficult of experiences. A list of supports and services can be found in a link below the podcast and will also be announced at the end of this recording. Thanks for listening and let me introduce you to our theme and guests today. In this episode, the conversation takes place in the Cavan Monaghan Drug and Alcohol Service with Zoe Wells, the service coordinator there, Dermot, who is a support worker who came through the service on his own journey of recovery from addiction, and Eileen, a family member whose son is in recovery. All three contributors offer their own unique and valuable insight into their perspectives on addiction, mental health and recovery. I hope you find the conversation helpful.
Just by way of introduction, we have you, Zoe. Will you just say, Zoe, what you do here?
Yep, I'm the service coordinator of Cavan Monaghan Drug and Alcohol Service.
Yeah, so I'm Dermot. I'm a support worker here. I've attended here from my own recovery for 4 years.
Hi, I'm Eileen. I'm a family member. My son is in recovery at the moment. He's attending MQI.
So Dermot, can I come to you first? What brought you into addiction in the first place and some of your story, if that's okay?
Yeah, absolutely. I was conscious of drugs from probably around the age of 11. There was some guys in my school who started smoking cannabis at that age. I was only in fifth class and I went out with them, but I didn't start smoking it myself. Then as a teenager, I knew that I had relations that were involved in drugs, and I used to hear stories about it, like other people looked up to them almost, but I was very poverty conscious. I have a massive family and we wore hand-me-downs and things like that. I always felt a bit less than in that sense. And someone who lived near me who was involved in sports and things like that gave me my first drug. Someone who would have been an upstanding member in the community, you know, he offered me, I really trusted him, he offered me cannabis when I was about 14. That's the first time I took it. I just remember laughing a huge amount and food tasting a whole lot better. That was it. I started smoking cannabis, and very soon after I was dealing cannabis, and I think it wasn't much of a long time before I was taking ecstasy. But when, I could never really say that I massively enjoyed cannabis, but I did enjoy how I escaped me. Right? A very sort of a negative look about myself. I was quite funny and cheeky, but I did always feel a bit less than. But when I took ecstasy, I had a euphoric rush. I felt so insanely happy, like everything in the world made sense. And I just had this rushes through my body, warm, fuzzy feelings through my body, and a feeling of intense love for everything and everyone around me. And I fell in love with ecstasy. Very young, I started what they call problematic. I went through recreational, but I started dealing for people. I was very much manipulated. I owed money all the time. I was terrible at being a drug dealer. I was very good at being a good drug taker. So I took more drugs than I sold, and when I sold drugs I gave them on credit and didn't get paid, and I fell into the grip of older people who sort of used me for things, and then I started stealing to pay for my habit, and you know, being encouraged to steal by people who sort of groomed me into this, to taking and selling of ecstasy, you know, and it spiraled from there. I went from one chemical to another. I spent most of my life fighting and in debt, owing money, and when I was in there, fifth year in school, and sixth year, I would have minched a huge amount of school. I would have stayed. I owed money. I was under threat by people. I owed money to the police were searching me all the time. My parents didn't know what to do. lost a huge amount of weight. I got very emaciated in secondary school. It was pretty heavy, very young. But my mental health back then was chaotic. I sort of blocked that out for years, but it's come back to me recently that young was pretty chaotic, because it moves throughout the years. I moved away from really heavy, problematic and drug dependence back to into sort of recreational, where it was only, but it might just be a weekend sometimes, and then, you know, I get a year where I seem sort of stable in my drug taking, and then it spiral again. So I moved through different kinds of benzodiazepines along with me, ecstasy and speed and cocaine, and eventually progressed on the heroin. And I smoked heroin. I was addicted to heroin twice, and crack cocaine for a period, and I was addicted to ketamine, and I was addicted to nearly all the drugs that are available in Ireland. I lived in the UK for a period as well. And I suppose you only really ask what led me into it, but I had about 21 years between when I first took drugs to when I was fully drug free.
Wow, yeah, that's a long time, isn't it? Mm. Saying that, you know, you've had your first smoke at 14, mm. and then, you know, so 21 years, that's a huge part of your growing up and your development into adulthood and all. And the progression is very clear in there, and you paint a very stark picture of all of that. And I'm curious, Dermot, because you mention being addicted to particular drugs. Is it the drug, or is it the oblivion? Or I have this idea that addiction is meeting some need in a person. And can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Fundamentally, very young, I realised that I didn't really like me. And that's, right. So there is a way, if something makes you feel different, you don't. You know, I liked me when I was stoned or high or elated, buzzing. It mightn't have been positive in society, but inside my body and in my head, I felt good, and I didn't always feel good. So in a sense, it is medicating. I wouldn't have been massively aware of that as a child. I was a child when I started taking drugs. Even as an adult, I probably became aware of it at some point, that it was just I had to escape myself. I couldn't be with myself. You become an outcast when you're involved in drugs and drug addiction and drug dealing. You become an outcast, and even being involved in dealing is like an addiction in itself. There's a buzz to it. There's a new persona, and it's negative to some people, but to other people it's quite positive. And you have this dual relationship, but you love it and you hate it, because it makes you an outcast, but you're accepted by this little group of other outcasts. The whole thing, it's sort of medicating something. It's escapism. Yeah, I mean, I made it sound very bleak. There was times when I loved being on drugs, like I absolutely loved taking them, but I hate what they've done to my life, what they've done to everything about my life, you know.
Can you talk to me a bit about that, about what it did do to your life?
Well, I failed my Lehman cert. I felt like as a teenager, I was known for drugs. I was known for the stuff that goes with drugs and thievery and dealing. I wasn't wanted around by the people I'd grown up with. Parents no longer wanted me around. It made my relationships at home really, really hard, very young. And as I moved away from home, I had partners who I usually met through taking drugs and parties. But as soon as we were going out and living together, they wanted their life to change. But my life couldn't change. I had dependency on drugs for a long period of time, but they might have been party users. I was always a daily user of drugs. The drugs might change form. I was just addicted to escape and derma. And so the problems in my relationships, never been able to hold down jobs. I was good at getting them for periods. When I moved away from my hometown where my name wasn't known, I could get nearly any job. I just couldn't maintain them. Eventually I came to the point where even like just grooming and things like that was very difficult. You know, I wear dentures now. My teeth, I lost a lot of my teeth through my drug use, and I had so many broken and fractured relationships. I got blacklisted at some point because I didn't pay a bank loan. I was under threat because I owed money most of my life. I constantly felt a sense of threat. I was always in fight or flight. I was very rarely relaxed. I had run-ins with police. You know, there's just one issue after another seems to come. You get points of recess from this kind of stuff, and then it spirals again, you know. So all the things that people take for granted, like family and relationships, all that stuff gets really hard. Just day-to-day living, you know, day-to-day grooming at points gets really difficult.
And when you say grooming, you mean the sort of self-care?
Self-care, yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, things like keeping appointments or filling out forms was impossible. It was impossible. I had days when I'd get out of the shower, and it was the worst thing in the world. I had to dry myself because I just felt so unmotivated that my energy would be totally gone. And there's the lack of motivation and the lack of self-worth. When your behaviour kind of feeds into this notion of you're the waste or the useless, your behaviour sort of backs that up. So yeah, I really start to believe the sort of societal stigma that's attached to addiction becomes your identity.
Massive, isn't it? Wow, thank you for all that. Something you said there, you became addicted to escaping Dermot. So how then do you turn that around from being addicted to escaping Dermot to stepping onto the road to recovery and, you know, subsequently becoming a support worker for other people on that journey?
Well, that's really hard. Like, dealing with the dependency on drugs before you can even deal with not trying to escape yourself, because you're still taking drugs, you're still escaping drugs, whether you're escaping yourself, whether they're prescribed or not, and for a long time after, you know, it's learning to sit with yourself. The only way to do it is to do it. The only way to learn to do it is to do it, and it's a real battle. It's a battle in the mind. When you don't like yourself, if you don't like yourself, how is anyone else supposed to? The only way to learn to be able to sit with yourself is actually to begin doing it, and it's honestly, I found it hell for a long time. There's a saying, like, if you find yourself in hell, don't stop, don't stay there, keep going. The only way to keep going is to learn to actually do it. So I had a lot of encouraging people around that I talked to, and that through here in the services and at home. And it was hard for them as well, but there's no easy way, you know. You get over the chemical dependency, then your emotions, all the buried hurt, all the core beliefs are coming to the surface. The truth about you and how you view yourself and how you assume the world is viewing you—you know—it's all there. It's really raw and really bare, and you sort of just have to sit with a lot of that stuff and learn to be uncomfortable. Then eventually, you start to become comfortable, and then you can challenge it. You know, is this actually true? But it takes—it's a process. Mm-hmm. It's not an event.
Yeah, I think that's very powerful, that learning to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very powerful place to be able to be, and you need a lot of support around you to do that, I guess.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I come to you, Eileen, and ask you then, from your perspective?
Yeah. Well, listening to you, Dermot, now, an awful lot of what you said resonates with me as regards my son.
Okay.
Killian has had mental health issues. He always has. But for a long time, he fought against it. He didn't want to admit he was going through the teenage years as well. He coupled that, and it was very difficult. Now, a lot of it at the time, I wasn't aware of, because, well, he didn't talk to me. We all, as a family, trying to get him to talk, but sure, he just closed up on himself, you know. Lately now, as I said, he's been to two treatment centres, and he's now in with Zoe and Dermot at the minute. Now, since he's come back from the treatment centres, that he's a lot more open, he's communicating a lot more. But I found out so much stuff that I was in total shock. Like, you know, I didn't realise that he had been drinking from an early age and drinking a lot. And then he went on to take coke, as far as I know. But it was all to do with his self-image, his self-esteem, like that he didn't like himself. He's working on it. I think he still doesn't like himself, I don't think very much. But because of his substance abuse, he, like that, his eating habits, I'm not sure, they were so erratic, he hardly ate anything. He'd be up and down at the night time. He went down to, I would say, a 26-inch waist in jeans. It didn't hit me until one night he had a shower and he came out in his underwear. And I seen his ribs, and I thought, oh my God, I knew you were thin, but I didn't realise you were that thin. I still didn't get it. I realise now, sure, I wasn't moving in those circles, so I wasn't going to get it anyway. It was my brother who alerted me to the fact that he felt Killian was on drugs. And I just, I suppose you could say I went into shock, because I thought to myself, how did I not see it? How did I miss it? Killian's love is agriculture. Now, he'd spend all day, every day, working outside, and agriculture and sheep is his love. And during COVID, when everything was in lockdown, he was going out, supposedly doing agricultural work with this lad who was a few years older than him. And at the time, I remember saying to my mother, in my innocence and naivety, this is great, he's getting something, you know, he's mixing with somebody, he's out working, and he's not stuck at home. It's helping his mental health. He's not sitting up in his bedroom. But sure, little did I know that at the time he was going down further and further down that road. And when I found out then, sure, what did we do? What do we do? We were totally, like, the house was chaotic. We spent our time, I think, trying to revolve around Killian, trying to keep Killian going, you know. And then I started to, I suppose you could say I was a nerve wreck. When he was out then, I was constantly checking on him. I was ringing to see where he was, and then I was driving him nuts. But he wasn't seeing it from the point of view, a mother's point of view, you know, that kind of a ratio. Killian was wrapped up in Killian, and he did tell me later on the ADHD, which is what he has as well. Coke usually brings people, gives them, I don't know what to be wrong, gives them energy, gives them a buzz. Whereas with Killian, it was calming him down, you know. So he started taking it, he wasn't even going out. I'd imagine he got the drug dealer to come down the road, and he was taking it in his bedroom. And I knew he was taking it in his bedroom. And I didn't know what to do. I wanted to stop it, but, like, I was totally uneducated as regards this, you know, and I was going out of my head worrying.
Eileen, can I ask you about the impact on you as a mother, as a parent, and the impact on your mental health? You have referred to being a nervous wreck. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I suppose the dynamic in the house revolved, as I say, around Killian. I used to lie awake at night wondering, when is he coming in? And then when I'd hear the car arriving in, or whoever was dropping him off, I thought, right, he's home. At least he's home. But it made it even more difficult, because I knew what he was doing upstairs, and he was spending so much time in his room alone. He was so lonely.
Yeah. Ah, yeah.
What do you want? But it broke me hard, because I couldn't do anything for him, and that was very, very hard on me. Our relationship as husband and wife, well, thanks be to God, I can say that we do have a very strong relationship. But we were so busy trying to cope and get by our daily lives that we just stopped talking. We were just, the sole conversation revolved around Killian, and we couldn't be ourselves. You know, we couldn't be husband and wife, because all we could see and think about was Killian. Now, I was very aware too, I put myself under pressure, because I felt I had two girls as well. And I worried that maybe they would feel that I had forgotten about them, you know, which wasn't the case at all. I always try. They actually told me that later on. Never worry, ma'am, we never felt that at any stage, because you were always there for all of us. And that is my thing. I'm learning that now, that, okay, I'm a mother, but I have to be me as well. I have to have time for me, and I have to look after me, because I was definitely going downhill. My own mental health was suffering big time, because it was having such a detrimental effect on me. And as I say, my husband probably, he coped differently. He just he went out, we say, and he worked on the land, or, you know, whereas me, as you can see, I just let it all out. But he's different to me. He doesn't talk as much about it. So I suppose we had difficulty actually vocalising what was going on. At no stage, even before we started to go to family support, at no stage did he blame me or I blame him, because it wasn't our fault in the beginning. You know, we didn't need anybody to say that to us, because we are, I suppose, we're very lucky. We're a tight item, and I'm sure it would drive others apart, but we stuck in there, and we're still sticking in there, and we're sticking in with him as well, because that's our family unit. Is a very strong family unit, and we have strong family values, and we're just not prepared to give up yet. As a group, we're not. So we have had discussions with Killian, and boundaries have been laid down, and as I say, we're going to family support because we need that. It's great now, I have several people that I can call on. I know they're at the end of the phone, and I take full advantage of it. When I feel I need to talk, or I feel I need to rant or just cry, I take it. And I'm also going in here myself for counselling, and I'm not one bit worried about saying that I'm not, because it's been my lifeline.
Okay. Yeah.
So they're the things I'm doing to help me.
Yeah, and that's really important.
Yeah.
And I can see, you know, and thank you for sharing so openly, you know, about that. Zoe, listening to Dermot and Eileen here now, what are your thoughts then, and where do you come into this stage of the story, if you like?
Yeah. I suppose as a service, what we provide both in Cavan and Monaghan to individuals that are experiencing substance use issues and their families is the support. So from individuals in addiction, we provide key working, case management support and counselling support. And then we provide family support. So that could be the five-step program or counselling, or we also provide a parenting under pressure program as well.
Okay.
Yeah. In addition to that, we provide a drug rehabilitation CE scheme. So that's a Department of Social Protection funded project, a DSP funded project. And we help people reintegrate back into community and working life. So I suppose in the early stages of the community employment scheme would be stability, structure and a routine. And tapped onto that would be training and education, so getting them ready for job, I suppose, and they can engage in that program for about 3 years. So those are the supports we offer.
Yeah, and I suppose just listening to Dermot and Eileen, what sort of stage do you see people? Presumably they're on their knees when they're coming to you,
aren't they? I mean, it depends on the individual. Sometimes family members will refer people in, because there's something happened over a weekend that's prompted that call for them to contact us. Or, you know, the individual is at a point where they have nowhere else to go, or no support structure, either that they've had relationship breakdowns with family members, they've been homeless. It depends on the individual. Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
We have seen an increase in people accessing our service with mental health issues. So we could be dealing with anything from suicidal ideation to anxiety, depression, or some of the complex people with more complex needs, such as personality disorders and schizophrenia. And they could have other co-occurring disorders as well, such as PTSD, ADHD, self-harm, eating disorders. Yeah.
And I suppose psychosis tends to go hand in hand sometimes too, doesn't it,
with
the substance abuse.
So it's so important for that early intervention piece to happen when a person's in psychosis. And the support network that needs to be collaboratively working together to treat that. The statutory and voluntary agencies need to come together to work collaboratively. for the best treatment outcome for a client, accessing the service. I suppose within the National Drug Strategy it outlines that we need to work jointly to give the client the best treatment outcome.
Can I come back round then to you, Dermot? Can you share your thoughts a little bit on the relationship between addiction and mental health?
Well, I think there's two things around that. There's mental health issues that might lead someone into addiction. There's also mental health issues that will stem from someone's addiction.
Okay.
I don't think I had any mental health issues when I started taking drugs. I believe it was more a self-image issue and a, you know, like I said, feeling less than. But I took drugs in such a way that I ended up, I was never diagnosed. I didn't seek help till I was in my 20s. I would have had psychosis at a few times in my life, or extreme paranoia, extreme fear, delusions, hearing voices. Every time I had it happen, and then it would be, someone would interact in my life that would change my circumstances somewhat, and I'd break away from the intensity of my drug use for a while. My drug use never stopped. It would change form, but the intensity would kind of go into a recess for a while, and I would forget how insane it was, and gradually it would get worse again. But toward the end of my drug use, I had I used to think I was a demon. I was taking a concoction of different drugs. I was flicking between being on heroin and cocaine to tablets and ketamine, and I was swapping all of these, and I was on a methadone prescription. I used to spend days and days awake, and my mental health was severe. I ended up having a heart attack, and that was sort of the turning point for me. But scarier than the physical pain of having a heart attack and nearly losing my life was where my mental health was. And I was afraid to tell anyone. I didn't know much about mental health issues. I really felt like if I didn't have a heart attack and realised I didn't want to die, I probably would have tried to kill myself anyway, because it was hell. It was hell, and I was frightened to tell anyone that this is where my head is and has been for some time. I didn't know what was real and what wasn't, and I went through periods of extreme paranoia, but particularly near the end it was just really, really scary. I found life quite frightening.
Eileen, what are your thoughts, please, about the relationship between addiction and mental health?
Well, I think as regards my own son, definitely for when he was at school, he was struggling, as I say. He didn't really speak very much about it. He didn't speak to me anyway, and as a result, they shut themselves off, or they become, from what I was told, the class clown. So that would have been my son's way of coping with it. He had he has a learning disability. It's difficult for him to admit, we'll say, anything has to do with that, in connection with that. So I would imagine that, he started to take the drugs to help him feel better about himself, as I say. But it didn't really. It made him feel worse about himself.
Addiction and mental health, people are doubly stigmatised, I suppose. In reaching out for supports, it's important that both are treated at the same time.
Sure.
It's impossible to treat it separately.
Yeah.
It has to be treated together.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's not going to prevent relapse in drug use if someone's got to a stage where they have maintained their abstinence, but the mental health is triggering drug use again, or cravings and urges to use. The thing that we hear consistently in the service is that sort out your addiction issue first, and then we can sort out your mental health. But it's impossible to do that. It has to be treated together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask you what recovery means to you, Dermot?
I actually love this question because I've thought about this a lot. Recovery to me is regaining the potential and the possibilities for the future that was lost in my addiction. I feel like I don't know if you've ever watched old movies where they've got two armies fighting against each other and they have a shield wall and they gain ground, they push. It's like regaining that ground and holding it. But it's a possibility for what you can do on that ground then.
Yes.
Yeah. It's free, like it's freedom.
Freedom, yeah. Lovely. Thank you. Eileen, what does the word recovery mean for you personally?
Personally, well, I would like to be able to detach with love.
Okay.
I want to be able to support Killian, but I want to be able to step back and work on myself as well. And I think if it works hand in hand, if I get myself more on track, I think that'll help Killian as well.
Mm-hmm.
But both recoveries are important.
Yeah.
And as regards Killian's recovery, I just want him to be happy and be a whole individual as I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And to look in the mirror and to like who he sees.
Yeah. And what about you, Zoe? What does the word recovery mean for you?
I think it's about any positive change that any individual can make that works towards reaching their full potential. Recovery is a process, like Dharma mentioned earlier on, and to make big changes takes time.
Yeah.
So it's around slow and steady, I suppose. I suppose from a practitioner point of view and an addiction point of view, recovery is about meeting someone where they're at, supporting them to reach their full potential and to blossom.
Yeah, well, I just like to add, you know, that I really think a massive part of recovery is reconciled relationships, reconciled to yourself, but also to your loved ones. I've had an amazing relationship with both of my parents now. I feel like we're friends and never felt like we were friends, not even as children before any of these issues were alive in me. But and reconciled to neighbours who didn't like to see me coming in.
Family members, I suppose, tend to try and fix the issues for the people in addiction.
Mm.
And then they lose themselves in that process.
Yeah.
So that's where family support is great, to be able to have that space, to be able to talk about those things.
Can I ask then about silver linings? Is there a silver lining in all this for you, Dermot?
I actually wouldn't change a day.
Okay.
I've hurt a lot of people and I've been hurt by a lot of people in situations, and I have peace in my mind now. Not only that, but I get to be active, partake in other people finding peace of mind. And I've really great relationships with my family. And I feel like it's sometimes things are like a muscle where they get stretched. But if they're given the right nurture, that they can grow and become bigger and stronger. And I feel like that's what happened in a lot of my relationships. And I don't know any other way than the way I've lived. But I know those times when I wish I didn't live at all, or times I wish certain things didn't happen, but I wouldn't change a day. Like, I work here now with people, and it's a slow process, but it makes me feel something. Maybe I wouldn't understand that as well had I not been through it. And life does get better, you know, all the doors opened up. We've done different kinds of public speaking and things, and I've been in a few places since, and I've just got engaged. And, you know, yeah, thank you very much. But yeah, like life actually is livable and enjoyable. Without, I don't have loads and loads of money. I don't have big huge dreams to conquer anything or anything like that. You know, I'm pretty content. And I think that there's no more of a silver lining than having peace in your mind than contentness.
Thank you. Eileen, what about you? A silver lining in all this story?
Silver lining. Well, I suppose as regards relationships there again, we are talking more, so we're learning more, you know. So that's great. Communication is very important. And we're all growing, as in we're getting to understand more, and we're not being so judgmental. We're more accepting. Yeah, we're in a better place now. It was a very unpleasant journey to have to go through to get there, And we're still, there's still an awful lot, I am talking in as in we, but there's an awful lot for everybody as individuals, as my son, myself, the rest of my family. We still all have a long way to go, but we have a better understanding now than we would have ever had, you know, and I know more, would say, about my son than I would have ever known before. So I'd be hoping the same about him as regards me. So that would be my silver lining. Mm. So.
Mm, that's lovely. And Zoe, what about the silver linings for you?
I suppose as an organisation and a service, we just keep doing what we're doing. And hopefully with Merchants Quay, we can grow the service and support more families and individuals.
So there we leave the conversation. Individuals can self-refer to the Cavan and Monaghan Drug and Alcohol Service, or they can be referred by a support agency. To make a referral, you can call 049 437 9160 or email info.cavan.monaghan@mqi.ie. And the phone lines are manned Monday to Friday from 9 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. There's also a family addiction support network that covers Cavan, Monaghan, Louth and Meath, and it's another source of support for families living with addiction. You can contact Family Addiction Support Network on 042 93 55 251 or 087 904 6405. You can also email them at info.fasn@gmail.com. You can also visit their website for more information on www.fasn.ie. If you'd like to avail of support or information on services for yourself or someone you know, you can visit the HSE website www.yourmentalhealth.ie for general information as well as how and where to get support. You should always contact your GP, doctor, or other health professional you might be in contact with if you have concerns about your mental health and well-being. In the event of an emergency, call 999 Emergency Services if you or someone you know is at risk of harming themselves. For further resources and information on recovery and promoting mental health and well-being, please visit www.mentalhealthireland.ie/resources, where there are a wide variety of downloadable resources, webinar recordings, videos, and links that are informative and supportive, including family recovery, farming and mental health, mindfulness practices, recovery colleges, and more. In the next episode, we'll be talking about eating disorders and recovery. Thanks for listening to this episode of Stories of Recovery, and bye for now.